The Sunstone Theological Society presents Christ and the Constitution Toward a Mormon Jurisprudence, recorded live at the 1988 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 17th through the 20th, 1988. We take you to the University Park Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
Jurisprudence. Is there anyone here that's lost or didn't have their proper registration or ticket? And if so, we can certainly help you with that. In the sake of time and to keep moving, I think we'll go ahead and get started and hope that Lou, who has, I'm sure, read the paper, will be here to comment on it sometime. Our speaker, there has been a change in the program. The paper was co-authored by Stephen C. Clark, who is shown as a presenter, who's an associate attorney with LaBeouf, Lamb, Levy, and McRae in New York City. He's been unable to attend. It was co-authored by our speaker today, Rick Van Wagner, who is an associate attorney with Snow, Christensen, and Martineau, a Salt Lake City firm and a renowned one. Let's start with Steve. Steve was a graduate of BYU as an undergraduate in English and then attended the University of Utah Law School. And Rick, who is our presenter, attended the University of Utah Law School and Weber State as an undergraduate. He graduated in 1985 from Weber State in 1982. Rick is married and has two children, and he tells me his wife, who is near the front here, is going to about ready to deliver a third. So we congratulate them on that. So without further ado, and to make sure that we keep moving, we will go ahead then and ask Rick to get started. Now, Rick, we have a choice. You can go to the podium and pass the microphone over there. You can stand here or sit here, whichever you think you'd prefer.
I think I'll stand. Thanks. I'm grateful for this forum. I'm thankful for the First Amendment that seems to be alive and well in the United States, and I hope that that inspired concept is alive and well in the Mormon Church as well. To the extent that we have anything of substance to say, Steve Clark gets the credit, and I'll take credit for the rest. In 1987, Americans celebrated the 200th anniversary of the United States Constitution. Patriotic speeches, lively parades, and solemn ceremonies commemorated the miracle of Philadelphia, that most extraordinary and successful experiment in self-government that is the Constitution. Against this celebratory backdrop, however, a series of constitutional dramas unfolded as if to remind us that constitutional self-government is indeed a delicate balance. First, the Iran-Contra hearings made stars of so-called heroes and patriots who, in the name of democracy, allegedly violated the law, subverted democratic processes, and flouted the authority of Congress to pursue their own political agenda. Next, an increasing military presence in the Persian Gulf brought to center stage the continuing struggle between the executive and legislative branches of government over their respective roles in conducting foreign relations and exercising the war power. And finally, the controversial nomination of Judge Robert Bork to a key position on the United States Court drew a chorus of opposition and incited debates that focused not on his unassailable paper credentials, but on deeper questions of judicial philosophy and temperament. As the curtain fell on the bicentennial year, serious questions remained about the future of our constitutional republic. The coincidence of these events generated an unusual degree of public interest in the Constitution. Topics previously confined to such rarefied tomes as law reviews and philosophical journals became the subject of more common discourse. Nowhere was this development more evident than in sermons from the Mormon pulpit. For Mormons, the Constitution is a literal as well as a political miracle. An important part of the Mormon cultural religion is the belief that God set apart, God set America apart as a land choice above all other lands, and raised up wise men to establish a republican form of government in preparation for the restoration of the gospel in the last dispensation. The Mormon celebration of the Constitution, of the Constitutional Bicentennial, thus resembled a sort of religious revival. The revival was led by a prophet whose apostolic ministry has centered on what he has called our three great loyalties, God, family, and country. In a series of speeches and publications during the bicentennial of the Constitution, President Ezra Taft Benson summarized his view of the proper role of government under the Constitution. In a booklet entitled The Constitution, A Heavenly Banner, published by Deseret Book in 1986, President Benson discussed constitutional principles in both a temporal and an eternal context, offering his view of the derivation and application of these principles. He praised the founders' inspired framework for freedom, but lamented that recent history reflects an erosion of freedom, a sort of constitutional apostasy, or falling away from the fundamental principles on which the founders' vision was based. And he ominously warned of a major crisis. Quote, "Momentum is gathering for another conflict, a repetition of the crisis of 200 years ago. This collision of ideas is worldwide. Another monumental moment is soon to be born. The issue is the same that precipitated the great premortal conflict. Will men be free to determine their own course of action, or must they be coerced?" President Benson called upon the saints to prepare for the impending crisis by studying and pondering the Constitution and abiding by its principles. What follows is our response to that call. We share President Benson's belief that insight can be gained from thinking about constitutional principles in both a temporal and an eternal context. Moreover, we share a belief in many of the fundamental principles he discusses, foremost among which is agency, the power of man to become as God through meaningful choice. But we must confess at the outset that we do not share his view of the role of government. Indeed, our interpretation of the Constitution in light of gospel principles leads us toward a much different view. The Constitution is indeed an inspired document. Its inspiration is in embodying the framers' revolutionary spirit in an institutional framework that allows, indeed encourages, each generation to decide for itself the most important questions of human existence and association. A surprising doctrinal and institutional affinity between the Constitution and true religion emerges from this view. The Constitution, like the gospel, consists of fundamental principles by which people are to govern themselves. And constitutional government, like the church, is a human institution, human in the sense that its implementation, as opposed to its design, is subject to the limitations and frailties of mere mortals, whose highest ideal is to provide an environment of ordered liberty in which people can grow toward their limitless potential. This paper is part of the author's struggle to understand and resolve deep conflicts between our own views of the Constitution, which we believe are rooted in gospel principles, and those of our prophet. We do not claim to be prophets of either the gospel or the Constitution, nor do we claim that anyone who disagrees with us is unfaithful or unpatriotic. We simply seek to contribute to the dialogue that President Benson began toward a Mormon jurisprudence. We shall refer to the theory set forth in President Benson's speeches and publications as the Orthodox jurisprudence. This Orthodox jurisprudence is based on a few basic eternal principles. The first principle is agency. In the primordial council in heaven, the central issue was whether the children of God would have untrammeled agency or be forced to be obedient. Satan, of course, stood for the latter, and having been cast down to earth, continues to foster the same plan, primarily through the power of earthly governments. The second principle is that the function and proper role of government is to secure the rights and freedoms of individual citizens, including the free exercise of conscience, the right and control of property, and the protection of life. Third, the basic source of human rights is God. Therefore, government cannot rightfully infringe those rights. Fourth, people are superior to the governments they form. Government's only source of authority and power is from the people who they have who have created it. Finally, government's powers are limited to those properly belonging to each and every person in the absence of and prior to the establishment of any organized form of government. This final basic eternal principle is the vehicle through which the other principles find expression and application to government. Legitimate government or legitimate governmental function thus is restricted to protecting the basic rights and freedoms of its individual citizens. Any exercise of governmental powers beyond that is usurpation and oppression. President Benson applies these eternal principles as follows. Quote, in a primitive state, there is no doubt that every individual would be justified in using force, if necessary, for defense against physical harm, against theft of the fruits of his labor, and against enslavement by another. By deriving its just powers from the governed, government becomes primarily a mechanism for defense against bodily harm, theft, and involuntary servitude. It cannot claim the power to redistribute money or property, nor to force reluctant citizens to perform acts of charity against their will. No individual possesses the power to take another's wealth or to force others to do good, so no government has the right to such things either. The sole object and only legitimate end of government is to protect the citizen in the enjoyment of life, liberty, and property, and when the government assumes other functions, it is usurpation and oppression. End quote. The Orthodox jurisprudence is informed not only by these basic eternal principles, but also by major provisions of the Constitution itself. First and foremost, the Constitution places sovereignty in the people themselves. Second, to safeguard inalienable or God-given rights, the Constitution separates the powers and responsibilities of government into three branches, executive, legislative, and judicial, to avoid a concentration of power. Third, to avoid the tyranny of unrighteous dominion, the Constitution limits the powers granted to government to enumerated functions. Fourth, the Constitution embodies the principle of representation, the delegation of powers to elected officials to represent the electorate. Fifth, the Constitution is an expression of higher law, God's law, and only a moral and a righteous people can acknowledge such pre-existing law and give it application. According to President Benson, our God-given freedoms, as derived and applied under the Orthodox jurisprudence, are being threatened today as never before. Federal agencies regulate and control the lives of millions of citizens, assuming all functions of government under one branch, in violation of the fundamental principles that underlie the constitutional system. According to the Orthodox jurisprudence, the Supreme Court usurps legislative prerogative in areas such as abortion, capital punishment, pornography, school prayer and Bible reading, criminal rights of appeal, public demonstrations, association and expression. Once fundamental principles are abandoned, he warns, the republican form of government established by our noble forefathers cannot long endure. Perhaps because of the authority of President Benson's ecclesiastical position and the strength of his convictions, not to mention the power of his rhetoric, the Orthodox jurisprudence has become a part of the Mormon cultural religion. This poses a difficult moral dilemma for those of us who try to be faithful Mormons and patriotic citizens, but whose faith and patriotism inspire a different view of the rule of law and the role of government. If the Orthodox jurisprudence is the extension of gospel tenets into the political arena, those who do not share this political view could easily be characterized as unfaithful in the gospel. The authors have struggled with this dilemma. We may be simply wrong, we may be sadly deceived, but we have reached the conclusion that this dilemma is false. Reaching that conclusion requires an unorthodox look at the Orthodox jurisprudence. The Orthodox jurisprudence assumes that government can rightfully possess only those powers individuals have in the absence of and prior to the establishment of any organized form of government. That posit, offered as a basic eternal principle, together with doctrinal and spiritual references to agency and the free exercise of conscience, is conceptually problematic. If government's proper role is merely an extension or embodiment of the powers properly possessed by individuals in a pre-government condition, then government must be a non-binding, non-authoritative, volunteer organization supported by contributions. But even under an extremely limited view of constitutional government, virtually all governmental action exceeds the rights individuals possess. Eminent domain, conscription, taxing, regulating commerce, providing for the general welfare, raising and supporting armies and maintaining a navy, coining and regulating the value of money, none is within an individual's power of agency, but each is among the enumerated powers of Article 1 of the Constitution. Indeed, one might easily argue that constitutional government exists precisely to empower people to do collectively what they cannot do individually. People band together and pool their resources for the common good. Individual freedom is sacrificed for the common welfare so that all may enjoy the benefits of living in the human community. Government thus becomes a liberating vehicle, a vehicle for progress from selfish individualism toward the unity of purpose that is characteristic of the kingdom of God. Even if one accepts the premise that government can do only what an individual would be entitled to do in a pre-government condition, the Orthodox jurisprudence does not consistently apply that premise. It asserts that in a pre-government condition, an individual's powers only include defense of his person and property. Therefore, government can legitimately perform those functions, but no individual possesses the power to take another's wealth or to force others to do good. Therefore, it is emphatically not within government's power to redistribute wealth. This characterization of the powers an individual possesses and the concomitant limitation of the powers government can properly exercise is arbitrary at best. If one examines the God-given rights and powers properly belonging to each person in a pre-government condition, they ultimately lie and are circumscribed only by agency itself. Individuals so situated are self-governing. They may choose for themselves how to live. They may choose to raise up arms in defense of their person or property and against involuntary servitude, but they may equally choose not to raise up arms for whatever reason, whether it be a belief in a higher law or other convictions in the free exercise of conscience in their own or in others' defense. Similarly, individuals in a pre-government condition may choose to impart of their substance or to render other charitable services to benefit the poor, the needy, the handicapped, and the aged, but they may equally choose not to engage in such charitable acts. Conceptually, one individual possesses the same power to force another to raise up arms in defense of person or property or against conceptually, one individual possesses the same power to force another to impart of her time or substance as she has to force another to raise up arms in defense of person or property or against involuntary servitude. In terms of impact on the free exercise of conscience, forcing one to take up a sword is the same as forcing one to give up a loaf of bread. Nevertheless, the former is justified under the Orthodox jurisprudence, ostensibly on the grounds of agency, and the latter is unjustified, ostensibly on the same ground. A similar inconsistency can be seen in the Orthodox jurisprudence's distaste for economic paternalism, but savor for moral paternalism. If no individual possesses the power to take another's wealth or to force others to do good, certainly no individual possesses the power to impair another's unfettered exercise of conscience in making important decisions of personal morality and individual expression, decisions that seem central to the notions of free agency and freedom of conscience. Nevertheless, the Orthodox jurisprudence defines areas of personal conscience in which government ought to have binding coercive authority, even though individuals would lack such power in a pre-government condition. For example, the Orthodox jurisprudence would permit the majority to prohibit abortion, mandate school prayer and Bible reading, prevent the distribution, sale, and exhibition of what they consider indecent, and curtail expression that offends their moral sensitivities, making extraordinarily personal judgments not only for themselves, but for others as well. A decision as to what an individual will do with the fruits of her labor thus becomes more important to the free exercise of conscience than the decision of what she will or will not do with her body, what she will or will not read, whether and to whom she will pray, what she will or will not say, and how, where and how she will or will not say it. In the Orthodox jurisprudence, the tyranny of a majority seeking to redistribute wealth is a more frightening specter than the tyranny of a majority seeking to restrict decisions of personal morality. In constructing the skewed hierarchy of values, the Orthodox jurisprudence is unwilling to extend its own principles to their logical conclusions. If government indeed has the power to act in these areas, it would be equally and appropriately within government's power to mandate abortions for mothers of two or more children, to mandate daily reading of the Kama Sutra in public schools, or to prescribe a morality that Mormons might find inconsistent with their beliefs and practices so long as the majority thought it proper. Yet, under the Orthodox jurisprudence, government's power to act in these areas extends only so far as the laws reflect the theory's conservative political agenda. Surely, as the Orthodox jurisprudence openly acknowledges, one purpose of constitutional government is to protect the individual's and the minority's rights and to define a sphere of conduct not subject to majority vote. The definition of that sphere is an agonizingly difficult task, but under the Orthodox jurisprudence, the task is made simple by centering the sphere of conduct on one's right to engage in the selfish pursuit of material wealth. We believe a Mormon jurisprudence can and should do better than that. The scriptures teach that God's purpose is to bring to pass the immortality and eternal life of man. God's plan for accomplishing that purpose was to enable or empower his children to mature spiritually by gaining knowledge and understanding, progressing eternally, and eventually becoming as God. Both Satan and Christ recognized the risks this plan entailed. Given unfettered choice, man would sometimes choose evil and thereby be lost to God. Satan proposed that God's children be saved from the consequences of choosing evil by preventing choice. Thus he thought all would be saved, and the glory would be his. God knew, however, that his plan could succeed only through the meaningful exercise of agency. Christ proposed not to prevent choice, but to redeem God's children from the consequences of choosing evil through his atoning sacrifice. Some would choose to follow Satan and would thereby be lost to God because of individual choice, but some would choose to accept Christ's sacrifice through repentance and would thereby gain eternal life. Christ's life and teachings give powerful effect and meaning to the concepts of agency and eternal progression central to God's plan. Christ's transcension of the Mosaic Law, difficult to conceptualize for those steeped in the religious culture and traditions of the time, offered values and meta-values, the true internalization of which would rightfully expose the individual to her limitless potential, allowing her to transcend her contexts through the exercise of her God-given agency. Christ taught us the evils of idolatry and the greatest motivation for good in people's lives through the first great commandment. Through the second great commandment, he taught us to eliminate barriers to material and spiritual development of ourselves and others. In the Sermon on the Mount, he taught us righteous motivations, the necessity for purity of heart and mind in our struggle to work out our salvation and to assist in that of others, even our enemies. He taught us to pacify and accommodate those who had harmed person and property. He taught us not to turn away the beggar, but to impart material and spiritual substance to others, because all of us are beggars, dependent upon God for all substance. He taught us humility, compassion, and service. He encouraged us to reach our divine potential by living his higher law. He exemplified his teachings in life and in death. What light do these teachings shed on constitutional interpretation? If the Constitution was ordained and conceived of God, having been drafted by inspired men to carry out his plan and purpose, then the Constitution ought to be viewed in a way that is consistent with God's plan, purpose and plan, as made meaningful in Christ's life and teachings. The inspired role of constitutional government thus becomes to create and sustain an environment in which God's children are exposed, with all the risks such exposure entails, to their own limitless potential. That purpose would be defeated if this Constitution were viewed as some kind of secular decalogue, forever etching in stone hard and fast rules of human association. The framers' inspiration was not, orthodox jurisprudence suggests, in prescribing that their vision of constitutional self-government, necessarily bound by their own experience and imaginations, should obtain for all succeeding generations. Rather, it was in institutionalizing their own revolutionary spirit in such open-ended phrases as liberty, due process, and equal protection, the precise contents of which are not susceptible of facile interpretation, but which permit continuing dialogue about who we are and how we should live. The history of these great constitutional provisions powerfully illustrates the depth of the framers' inspiration. Initially, the Bill of Rights was interpreted to insulate civil rights and liberties against arbitrary infringement by the federal government, an understandable source of anxiety to a people bloodied and battered by, but ultimately victorious over, a distant centralized government. The scope of the Bill of Rights prohibitions against governmental action, however, did not reach state legislative power. In Barron versus Baltimore, for example, Justice Marshall held that the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment did not preclude a state from taking private property for public use without just compensation. In the wake of the tectonic events of the Civil War and the Reconstruction, the 14th Amendment extended the protection of due process and added the protection of equal protection to insulate against arbitrary infringement of rights by state governments. Since then, due process and equal protection have been defined and redefined, but at their core they have always represented each generation's attempt to preserve individual rights and liberties and to extend them to all of God's children. One iteration of defining the Due Process Clause is the Incorporation Doctrine, which assures that the procedural and substantive guarantees in the Bill of Rights apply the same to state governments as they do to the federal government. The U.S. Supreme Court has long recognized the substantive content of due process and liberty to assure that rights fundamental to notions of freedom could and should be protected against arbitrary infringement by all levels of government. In 1925, the Supreme Court stated, "For present purposes, we may and do assume that freedom of speech and of the press, which are protected by the First Amendment from abridgment by Congress, are among the fundamental personal rights and liberties protected by the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment from impairment by the states." Since that time, every significant protection afforded the individual by the First Amendment and the remaining seven amendments against the federal government has been extended through the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment against impairment by the states. Further, the same exacting standards imposed by the Bill of Rights upon the federal government are laid against state action by the Due Process Clause without any loss of integrity. The nationalization of civil rights and liberties through the Incorporation Doctrine assured that government at any level could not arbitrarily impair fundamental individual rights. The history of the Due Process Clause contains both the roots of the orthodox jurisprudence and the buds of a more meaningful jurisprudence. The orthodox jurisprudence is rooted in a prior generation's concept of liberty known as economic substantive due process. Under that oxymoronic rubric, the Due Process Clause became largely a mechanism for constitutionalizing a common law system of economic distribution that was recognized as natural or fundamental. The Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment preserved the laissez-faire system of the common law through neutrality. The police power could be brought to bear only in extraordinary circumstances to meet a broad public purpose that was considered sufficiently neutral. Downstate laws that sought to remedy recognized social and economic ills on the ground that such laws were impermissibly partisan, impairing the received concept of liberty. The demise of substantive economic due process was the result of a theoretical shift in the Supreme Court and a startling revelation. Under economic substantive due process, government neutrality or inaction under the common law market system was seen simply as another form of partisanship, government's decision to rely on traditional market mechanisms. The common law was no longer regarded as unchosen or neutral. government's decision to support, through action or inaction, the received traditional market distribution was as much a subsidy for the economically advantaged and unconscionable employers as minimum wage laws would be for the economically disadvantaged. Once the common law itself was seen to allocate entitlements and wealth, and the allocation seemed controversial, a decision to generate a new pattern of distribution could not be, for that reason, impermissible. The traditional concept of the police power could not survive this new knowledge and was thus transformed into a tool to remedy social and economic problems, juxtaposing instead different conceptions of liberty, such as a system in which all workers had a living wage. In the post-New Deal welfare state, liberty has taken on a different meaning. It is no longer relegated solely to the right to earn and enjoy the fruits of one's labor. Instead, it has assumed a more personal connotation, a connotation that recognizes the right to self-discovery and self-expression through the meaningful exercise of agency in matters of personal conscience. One iteration of that developing notion of liberty is the right to privacy. The right to privacy is not explicit in the text or amendments of the Constitution, yet it has been called the most comprehensive of rights and the right most valued by civilized man. It has been broadly identified as the right of independence in making certain kinds of important decisions, with the concomitant right to conduct oneself in accordance with those decisions, undeterred by governmental restraint. This more personal concept of liberty actually can be traced at least as far back as 1923, when in the case of Meyer v. Nebraska, the Supreme Court stated that liberty includes one's freedom not only from bodily restraint and to make economic choices, but to acquire useful knowledge, to marry, establish a home, and bring up children, to worship God according to the dictates of his or her own conscience, and generally to enjoy those privileges long recognized at common law as essential to the orderly pursuit of happiness by free men. The 1965 case of Griswold versus Connecticut, however, was the first case to openly articulate a right to privacy as part of the liberty protected by the Due Process Clause. In Griswold, the Supreme Court invalidated a Connecticut statute prohibiting artificial contraception. Justice Arthur Goldberg, in a concurring opinion, stated that the concept of liberty protects those personal rights that are fundamental and is not confined to the specific terms of the Bill of Rights. He pointed to the language and history of the Ninth Amendment, which he said reveal that the framers of the Constitution believed that there are additional fundamental rights protected from government infringement, which exist alongside those fundamental rights specifically mentioned in the first 8 constitutional amendments. Among these rights are the right to marital privacy and to marry and raise a family. Certainly from a Mormon perspective, rights to be cherished and protected, even though not listed in the Bill of Rights. One case stands out as a particularly inspiring example of the law's ability to recognize, tolerate, and even encourage sincere self-realization. In United States versus Sisson, Judge Charles E. Wazanski refused to force a man to kill for his country. Quote, "Every man, not least the conscientious objector, has an interest in the security of the nation. Dissent is possible only in a society strong enough to repel attack. The conscientious will to resist springs from moral principles. It is likely to seek a new order in the same society, not anarchy or submission to a hostile power. Thus, conscience rarely wholly disassociates itself from the defense of the ordered society within which it functions and which it seeks to reform, not to reduce to rubble. In parallel fashion, every man shares, and society as a whole shares, an interest in the liberty of the conscientious objector, religious or not. The freedom of all depends on the freedom of each. Free men exist only in free societies. Society's own stability and growth, its physical and spiritual prosperity, are responsive to the liberties of its citizens, to their deepest insights, to their free choices. That which opposes also fits." The concept of liberty has thus progressed from economic freedom toward the freedom of conscience that holds the key to human potential. The developing law of equal protection, which seeks to ensure that liberty exists for all, represents yet another facet of the maturity in society's thinking toward the right to personhood through the meaningful exercise of agency. Not unlike those noble forefathers who, in freedom's name, challenged the oppressive rule of a distant, unsympathetic government, civil rights activists in this century struggled against imposing widespread ignorance and moral deficiency to revolutionize a political process that had denied them entry and had effectively insulated itself from democratic change. The higher order of liberty that resulted from this second American Revolution loosed the chains of ignorance and formed a social conscience more easily pricked by invidious discrimination. As in the case of due process, the judiciary's role in this evolution of thought has varied. However, through judicial insight, the Supreme Court has shown an increasing moral awareness seemingly absent in other branches and levels of government. By recognizing that government not only ought not to impair by law the exercise of agency, but also may at times have to take affirmative action to create an environment where such exercise is meaningful, especially where the impact of discrimination outlives the invalidation of its discriminating laws, the court has, so to speak, magnified its calling as a co-equal branch of government in the constitutional system of checks and balances. The mentality that prevailed at the beginning of the struggle for human dignity is now, for most of us, difficult to imagine. From slavery to emancipation to black codes and the separate but equal doctrine, this country, its leaders, and its courts struggled with the concept of equality. But in the landmark decision of Brown versus Board of Education, the Supreme Court finally recognized government's responsibility to ensure liberty and justice for all. Although Brown has been criticized and defended on many grounds, its effect was to shake the foundations of a received tradition and enable a new generation to decide for itself upon a proper model for human association. Succeeding generations would be free to make individual decisions of whom they would love, whom they would hate, and with whom they would associate, rather than being saddled with the limiting prejudice of their predecessors. Griswold and Brown are properly recognized as landmarks in their respective substantive contexts. On a different level, they represent trust. Our inherent skepticism of the individual's ability to make right choices and engage in correct conduct is in large measure the product of our inherited views of what is right and correct. To the extent we simply acquiesce in the received tradition, we limit our responsibility for personal growth and consequently our opportunity for self-discovery. To the extent possible in a system of ordered liberty, individuals ought not to be deprived of the opportunity for growth resulting from deciding for themselves how to live, by succeeding and failing on a personal level in developing values and living by them, by testing their own limits, by exploring their own paths of self-discovery and fulfillment. The freedom of the individual to decide matters of personal conscience and morality is not a constitutional crisis, but is a victory for trust, a liberation of the human spirit. In our struggle toward a Mormon jurisprudence, we deem constitutional government's primary function to be the creation and preservation of an environment of ordered liberty in which people can grow toward their own unlimited potential. A system of ordered liberty necessarily subjects certain interests to majority discretion in order to enhance social order and to improve conditions generally. Constitutional government's virtue, however, is its ability to exercise restraint in areas most significant to personal growth by not imposing a majority value and by allowing, even encouraging, individual standards for human conduct. Government is called upon to balance the interests of the individual and the majority using the Constitution as its guide. The adaptability of the substantive content of constitutional principles in light of the needs and adjustments of an evolving environment is the Constitution's inspiration, because it affords the open-ended opportunity to determine for ourselves who we are and how we should live, individually and socially, consistent with God's plan and purpose. The Constitution thus becomes a liberating tool in defining and characterizing more meaningful areas of human conduct that should and should not be subject to majority whim. We obviously draw a much different line than does the Orthodox jurisprudence on the proper balance of individual and majority interests on optimal personal growth for agents in God's plan. The Orthodox jurisprudence exalts economics above all other values and otherwise attempts to justify a paternal role for government to interfere in extremely personal moral decisions. The opportunity to engage in selfish pursuit, accumulation, and disposition of wealth, when balanced against competing interests and needs, is no less subject to majority discretion than are other matters of general concern under the express provisions of the Constitution. While we do not argue here with a pragmatic justification for free marketry, our background and heritage cause us to question whether the Constitution or the teachings of Jesus Christ mandates placing such a system the top priority of righteous government. In our jurisprudence, we choose not to exalt economic freedom above other types of freedom that we deem of equal or greater consequence in an eternal scheme. We recognize that our choice is itself value-laden. It reduces emphasis on materiality and prosperity, and thus may slightly impair the opportunity for personal gain and ultimate value to many. But we believe this choice is justifiable on both gospel and constitutional principles. Through redistribution of wealth, we have the collective opportunity, at relatively insignificant individual cost, to create and sustain an environment where many can rise above their circumstances and develop as human beings. Though the complacency and indifference of our predecessors tells us otherwise, the power is in us to remedy social injustice, the lingering stench of invidious discrimination, and to share the benefits of education and association, thereby enhancing what surely are the most ennobling aspects of life and developing a deeper and more meaningful prosperity for humanity. The benefits to society outweigh the small cost to agency. At the same time, we exalt and exult in freedom in matters of personal conscience and morality. We recognize a collective duty to balance those rights in order to preserve the benefits of liberty and social order. We also recognize the difficulty of fulfilling that duty. But if we must err, let us err on the side of personal choice in matters of personal conscience and morality, thought, ideas, expression, religion, association, and conduct. God's plan and the Constitution are meaningful not so much because of the choices that we make, but because we have choices to make. Thank you.
Has Lou Midgley come in? Good. Are you Lou? Excuse me. Oh, is anyone here? No, Lou? Have they seen Lou?
No, he's not here.
Okay. Sunstone made a mistake in choosing an engineer businessman to chair this session. And I'm certainly not prepared to make intelligent comments on this excellent paper, and we do thank Rick for doing so. I would suggest that if he's willing, and reluctantly so maybe, to take any questions from the floor, comments by those who are here regarding the points that he's made. Let me just make one kind of naive comment. I remember years ago reading the book A Miracle in Philadelphia, having been raised through the primary and in the Sunday schools of the church, thinking that God had been ultimately involved in the framing of the Constitution in a very real way, and finding that Benjamin Franklin, as some of you probably read that excellent book, had made a motion that they open and close the sessions with prayer, and that was voted down by the delegates to the Constitutional Convention. And it was not opened with prayer nor closed with prayer, which seemed to me to be quite an unusual way for God to be working through the Constitution. But that doesn't mean he couldn't have in other ways. But let me just say, let me just ask Rick if it was all right then to open the session to questions and comments that any of you have. If you have a comment, why don't you come to the microphone? If you have a question, why don't you just sit there and ask it to him, and we'll see what we can do. Is there any questions here on the front?
What exactly is the criticism you make, if any, of President Benson's approach to the Constitution?
Okay.
Don't put yourself on the line or anything.
I'm not defending taped. President Benson, but
no, this is being taped.
Could you just be a little more clear on that?
Okay. President Benson, for his entire public career, has come out in favor of an original intent interpretation of the Constitution, that the powers of government should be limited to the powers that basically limited to what was intended by the framers. It's not his alone. A lot of people believe that. Justice Bork, for example, holds that view. We have a different view of how the Constitution should be interpreted. That it's an evolving document. It's a live document. That it's an anti-majoritarian document, in the sense that its purpose is to protect the individual from governmental power, but it at the same time it establishes a great system in which to do that. We address various views, I guess, that are held by the original intent believers. We should be able to, as a society, vote to have Bible reading in the school, school prayer, those kinds of things that would impose, in my view, standards of conduct on people that, in some sense, may take away choice, may take away their own opportunity to make decisions for themselves. And that's, I think, basically the center of the paper, that we ought not be deprived, whenever possible, of the opportunity to make personal decisions, especially matters of personal conscience and morality. And the Orthodox jurisprudence identifies several areas where government ought to have binding coercive authority.
I understood that the framers of the Constitution did not add the Bill of Rights, because they felt to enumerate rights was dangerous. Something that was not in the Constitution was reserved to the individuals and the people of the country.
That's correct.
So therefore the right of privacy would automatically be reserved if it was not inhibited.
That's under the...
Enumerating things, but it's in the danger of saying what's not there, we don't have.
That's right, and there are people, Supreme Court justices, who hold that view and some that don't. The Bill of Rights was not a part of the original Constitution, but I think it was passed in the first Congress. That's my understanding.
Which amendment to the Constitution is it now that says that the rights that are not herein enumerated?
Let's see, is it
the
9th?
The 11th or the 9th? Or
ninth?
The 10th.
Yes,
the 10th.
Okay.
I wanted to make have your point clear. Was your point clear? That it is dangerous to enumerate rights because that restricts other rights.
That's what James Madison felt. He felt that we didn't need a Bill of Rights.
The expression of one thing excludes all others.
It's kind of like, in the sense, you shouldn't be commanded in all things, you know. Why not think a little bit?
Boy, a lot of questions, Wendell.
Rick, it appears to me that possibly the position being taken by President Benson is, from a majority standpoint, when the church in the early days were the victims of probably denial of constitutional rights. And it appears to me that maybe because of our size, we've come the full circle now, and we're getting to the point where we say, because we are big, we have the right, along with other Christian religions, to impose our will on others who may have different views. What do you feel about that?
There are footnotes to this paper. And we address that point in one of our footnotes with a quote by Joseph Smith. And if I can find it, I'll read it to you. Let's see, I've got to think of exactly where it is. Well, I don't know if I'm going to be able to find it here. The point that Joseph Smith made while I'm looking at it is that the Constitution is inspired, but it doesn't go far enough in protecting individual rights and freedoms. I think that the example of Mormon persecution that culminated in polygamy and the persecution that the church incurred due to polygamy shows that the church's view on individual matters of individual conscience and morality may have been different. Now we're kind of with the moral majority, and so I think your question is right. Here's the quote. "It is one of the first principles of my life and one that I have cultivated from my childhood, having been taught it by my father to allow everyone the liberty of conscience. I am the greatest advocate of the Constitution of the United States there is on the earth. In my feelings, I am always ready to die for the protection of the weak and oppressed in their just rights. The only fault I find with the Constitution is it is not broad enough to cover the whole ground. Although it provides that all men shall enjoy religious freedom, yet it does not provide the manner by which the freedom can be preserved, nor for the punishment of government officers who refuse to protect the people in their religious rights, or punish these mobs, states, or communities who interfere with the rights of the people on account of their religion." That statement was made by Joseph Smith 10 years after the case of Barron versus Baltimore, which... That case stated that the Fifth Amendment does not reach the states in protecting individual property, you know, from being taken without due process of law. This statement was made 10 years later, and then Joseph Smith sought help from the federal executive. And he said, "Your cause is just, but I can do nothing for you." We criticize him for that, but on constitutional grounds, he was right.
At the beginning of your talk, you said that you and your partner debated whether or not you wanted to take on President Benson.
That's right.
In essence, and I'd like to know a little bit more about your thinking on that. Here we have a prophet of God speaking in general conference, and at the close of the conference saying that these addresses are the mind and will of God for this next 6 months, and live by it. And you've undertaken to say that he's contradicted himself, that he's inconsistent, and that he basically didn't know what he was talking about as far as government's concerned.
Is this microphone on?
It's
being taped.
How did you rationalize it? How did you justify publicly wanting to criticize what he
had to
say?
Well, I'm not sure that I publicly want to. I felt a certain compulsion for some reason. That's the dilemma we felt all the way along. We're taking on a very serious matter. And he also, before he became the president of the church, spoke at BYU and gave a talk about 14 points of following the prophet, several points of which were the prophet can speak on secular matters, doesn't need any particular expertise. Follow and you're saved, and disobey and you're damned, basically. I guess I feel like a careful review of it reveals, a careful review of it reveals an equally plausible, if not more plausible, jurisprudence or interpretation of the gospel and gospel, using gospel principles as background theory. And that's why we did it. I guess maybe we're taking a risk, but it's a risk we're willing to take.
Well, we've been here an hour. We have a half an hour before the other session. I think if any of you would like to leave, feel free to do so. I'm sure Rick will not be offended by that. Excuse me?
15 minutes.
Oh, do we only have 15 minutes? 15 I guess our time is up then. Yeah. But we appreciate very much, Rick, your presentation. Thank you very much.